Clara was in no condition to spend her pregnancy in the country and give birth in the village, so they began getting ready to return to the city. This was of some consolation to Férula, who took Clara's pregnancy as a personal affront. She traveled ahead with most of the baggage and servants to open the big house on the corner and prepare for Clara's arrival. Several days later, Esteban accompanied his wife and daughter back to the city, leaving Tres Marías once again in the hands of Pedro Segundo García, whose responsibilities as foreman had brought him no more privileges, but only more work.
The trip from Tres Marías to the city used up all of Clara's remaining strength. I saw her grow paler and more asthmatic, with dark rings under her eyes. With the jouncing up and down, first of the horses and then the train, the dust of the road, and her natural inclination to get queasy, she was losing energy before my very eyes. There wasn't much I could do to help her, because when she felt ill, she didn't like anyone to talk to her. When we got out in the station, I had to hold her up because her legs were giving out. "I think I'm going to elevate," she said. "Not here," I shouted, terrified at the idea of Clara flying over the heads of the passengers along the track. But she wasn't talking about physical levitation. She meant she wanted to rise to a level that would allow her to leave behind the discomfort and heaviness of pregnancy and the deep fatigue that had begun to seep into her bones. She entered one of her long periods of silence. I think it lasted several months, during which she used her little slate as she had in her days of muteness. This time I wasn't worried, since I expected she would return to normal just as she had after Blanca was born. Besides, I had come to understand that silence was my wife's last refuge, not a mental illness, as Dr. Cuevas said it was. Férula looked after her as obsessively as if she had been an invalid. She refused to leave her alone and completely neglected Blanca, who cried all day long because she wanted to return to Tres Marías. Clara walked around the house like a silent, overweight shadow, with a Buddhistic indifference toward everything around her. She didn't even look at me. She walked right by me as if I were a piece of furniture, and whenever I spoke to her, she acted as if she were on the moon, as if she hadn't heard me or didn't know who I was. We hadn't resumed sleeping in the same bed. The lazy, empty days in the city and the irrational atmosphere in the house set my nerves on edge. I managed to keep myself busy, but it wasn't enough. I was always in a bad mood. I went out every day to check on my business affairs. It was around that time that I began speculating in the stock market, and I spent hours studying the ups and downs of international finance. I devoted myself to investing money, starting new companies, and importing. I spent a lot of time in my club. I also began to get involved in politics and even joined a gym where a gigantic trainer forced me to exercise certain muscles I hadn't even known I had. I had been advised to have massages, but I never liked them. I hate to be touched by mercenary hands. But none of this was enough to fill my days. I was uncomfortable and bored. I wanted to return to the country, but I didn't dare leave my house, where there was clearly need for a man among so many hysterical women. Besides, Clara was putting on too much weight. Her belly was so huge that it could barely be supported by her fragile frame. She was embarrassed to be seen undressed, but she was my wife, and I couldn't allow her to be ashamed in front of me. I helped her bathe and dress, if Férula didn't beat me to it, and I felt infinitely sorry for her, so tiny and thin with that monstrous belly as the moment of delivery approached. I lay awake at night thinking that she could die giving birth, and I would closet myself with Dr. Cuevas trying to figure out the best way to help her. We had agreed that if things didn't look good, it was better to do another cesarean, but I didn't want her to be sent to a hospital, and he refused to do another operation like the first one in the house. He said we didn't have the proper facilities, but in those days, hospitals were a major source of infection, and more people died in them than were saved. One day, a short time before her delivery date, Clara came down from her Brahmanic refuge without warning and began to speak again. She asked for a cup of hot chocolate, and then asked me to take her out for a walk. My heart skipped a beat. The whole house was filled with joy. We opened a bottle of champagne. I had fresh flowers put in all the vases, ordered camellias, her favorite flower, and carpeted her room with them until they began to give her asthma and we had to remove them in a hurry. I ran to buy her a diamond brooch on the street of the Jewish jewelers. Clara thanked me effusively and found it ever so lovely, but she never put it on. I suppose she must have locked it up in some unlikely place and then forgotten all about it, like almost all the other jewels I bought for her over the years we spent together. I called Dr. Cuevas, who came over on the pretext of having tea but was really there to examine Clara. He took her to her room and then told Ferula and myself that even though she seemed to have recovered from her mental crisis, we would have to expect a difficult delivery because the child was very big. Just then, Clara stepped into the sitting room. She must have heard his final sentence. "Everything will turn out fine," she said. "There's no need for you to worry."
"I hope this time it will be a boy so we can give him my name," I joked.
"It's not one, it's two," Clara replied. "The twins will be called Jaime and Nicolás, respectively," she added.
That was too much for me. I suppose I blew my stack from all the pressure I'd been under the preceding months. I got furious, arguing that those were names for foreign merchants, that no one in my family or hers had ever had such names, that at least one of them should be called Esteban, like myself and my father. But Clara explained that repeating the same name just caused confusion in her notebooks that bore witness to life. Her decision was inflexible. To frighten her, I smashed a porcelain jar that I believe was the last vestige of the splendid days of my great-grandfather. But she was unmoved. Dr. Cuevas smiled from behind his teacup, which only made me more indignant. I slammed the door behind me and went to the club. That night, I got drunk. Partly because I needed to, and partly for vengeance, I went to the best-known brothel in the city, which had a historic name. Now I want to make it clear that I'm not a man for whores and that I've only resorted to them during periods when I've been forced to live alone. I don't know what got into me on that particular day. I was annoyed with Clara. I was in a bad mood. I had excess energy. I was tempted. In those days, the Christopher Columbus was flourishing, but it hadn't yet acquired the international reputation it attained when it appeared on the navigational charts of the British shipping companies and in all the guidebooks, and when they showed it on television. I stepped into a sitting room with French provincial furniture, the type with twisted claws, where I was received by a native matron who did a perfect imitation of a Parisian accent. She reeled off the price list and asked me if I had anything special in mind. I told her that my experience was limited to the Red Lantern and a few wretched miners' whorehouses in the north, so that any young, clean woman would be fine with me.
"I like you, monsieur," she said. "I'm going to bring you the best in the house."
At her summons, a woman appeared sheathed in a black satin dress that was far too tight and could barely contain her exuberant femininity. Her hair was combed over one ear, a hairstyle I've never liked, and as she walked she gave off a terrible musky scent that floated on the air, as insistent as a moan.
"I'm glad to see you, patron," she said,
and it was then I recognized her. Because her voice was the only thing that hadn't changed about Tránsito Soto. She led me by the hand to a room shut like a tomb, its windows covered with dark curtains, in which the light of day could not have entered in eons, but which was nonetheless a palace compared to the sordid quarters of the Red Lantern. There I personally undressed Tránsito, undid her dreadful hairdo, and was able to observe that with the years she had grown taller, put on weight, and become more beautiful.
"I see you've made some progress," I said.
"Thanks to your 50 pesos, patron," she replied. "They helped me get started. Now I can return them to you readjusted, because with inflation they're not worth what they once were."
I'd rather have you owe me a favor, Tránsito, I said, laughing. I finished taking off her petticoats and verified that there was almost nothing left of the slender girl with jutting knees and elbows who had worked in the Red Lantern, except for her tireless sensual appetite and her voice that sounded like a hoarse bird. Her body was hairless, and her skin had been rubbed with lemon and cream of witch hazel, as she explained to me, which made it as soft as a baby's. Her nails were painted red, and she had a snake tattooed around her navel which could move in circles while the rest of her body remained absolutely still. While she was demonstrating her skill at making the serpent wiggle, she told me the story of her life.
What would become of me if I had stayed at the Red Lantern, Patron? I would have lost my teeth. I'd be an old woman now. You get used up fast in this profession. You have to look out for yourself. And I'm not even a streetwalker. I've never liked that. It's very dangerous. To work the street, you have to have a pimp. Otherwise, it's too risky. Nobody respects you. But why give a man something it's so hard to earn? In that respect, women are really thick. They're the daughters of rigidity. They need a man to feel secure, but they don't realize that the one thing they should be afraid of is men. They don't know how to run their lives. They have to sacrifice themselves for the sake of someone else. Whores are the worst, Patron, believe me. They throw their lives away working for some pimp, smile when he beats them, feel proud when he's well-dressed, with his gold teeth and rings on his fingers, and when he goes off and takes up with a woman half their age, they forgive him everything because he's a man. No, sir. I'm not like that. No one's ever supported me, and that's why you'll never find me supporting someone else. I work for myself, and whatever I earned, I spend as I see fit. It's been a struggle, believe me. Don't think I've had an easy time of it, because the madams of these places don't like to deal with women. They prefer pimps. They don't help you out. They have no consideration.
But it looks as if they really appreciate you here, Tránsito. They told me you're the best in the house.
I am. But this business would fall on its face if not for me, because I work like a horse. The rest of the girls are a bunch of dish rags. All we get now are old men. It's not the way it used to be. We ought to modernize the whole business, bring in civil servants who have nothing to do in the middle of the day, and young people, and students. We ought to get better furnishings, liven the place up, and clean it. Clean the whole place. That way, the customers would feel more trusting, and they wouldn't go around worrying about catching some venereal disease, right? The place is a pigsty. They never clean. Look, pick up the pillow, and I guarantee you a tick will come hopping out. I've told the madam, but she doesn't listen. She doesn't have a head for business.
And you do?
Of course, Patron. I have a million ideas for improving the Christopher Columbus. I bring enthusiasm to this profession. I'm not like those girls who go around complaining all the time and blaming their bad luck when things go wrong. Can't you see how far I've come? I'm the best now. If I put my mind to it, I could have the best house in the country. I guarantee you.
I was enjoying myself. I could really appreciate her, because I had stared at ambition so many times in the mirror when I was shaving in the mornings that I was able to recognize whenever I encountered it in others. I think that's an excellent idea, Tránsito, I told her. Why don't you open your own business? I'll advance you the money, I said, fascinated at the idea of broadening my commercial interests in that direction. I must have really been drunk.
No thanks, Patron.
Tránsito replied, caressing her snake with a lacquered fingernail.
There's no point in trading one capitalist for another. The thing to do is form a cooperative and tell the madam to go to hell. Haven't you ever heard of that? You better be careful. If your tenants set up a cooperative, you'll really be finished. What I want is a whores cooperative. Or whores and fags, to make it more encompassing. We'll lay out everything, the money and the work. What do we need a patron for?
We made love with a violence and ferocity I had almost forgotten after so much sailing in the ship of the gentle blue silk sea. In that chaos of sheets and pillows, clasped in the living knot of desire, screwed into each other to the point of fainting, I felt I was 20 again, and happy to be holding in my arms this bold, swarthy woman who didn't fall apart when you got on top of her, a strong mare you could ride on without giving it a second thought, who didn't make your hands feel heavy, your voice hard, your feet gigantic, or your beard too scratchy, but someone like yourself, who could take a string of bad words in her ear and didn't need to be rocked with tender arguments or coaxed with flattery. Afterward, sleepy and happy, I rested a while by her side, admiring the solid curve of her hips and the shudder of her snake. "We'll see each other again, Transito," I told her, giving her a tip.
"That's what I said before, Patron. Remember?"
she replied with a final flip of her serpent. The truth was, I had no intention of ever seeing her again. In fact, I planned to forget all about her. I wouldn't have mentioned this episode if Transito Soto hadn't played such an important role in my life a long time later, because, as I said earlier, I'm not a man for whores. But this story could not have been written if she hadn't intervened to rescue us, and in the process, our memories.
A few days later, while Dr. Cuevas was making preparations before opening Clara's belly up again, Severo and Nivia del Valle died, leaving behind numerous children and 47 living grandchildren. Clara found out in a dream before everybody else, but she told no one except Férula, who managed to calm her down by explaining that pregnancy produces a state of jumpiness in which bad dreams frequently occur. She redoubled her attentions, rubbing Clara's stomach with sweet almond oil to keep her from getting stretch marks, and her breasts with honey so her nipples would not split. She fed her powdered eggshells so her milk would be good and her teeth strong, and recited the prayers of Bethlehem for a healthy delivery. 2 days after her dream, Esteban Trueba came home earlier than was his custom, pale and disheveled, grabbed his sister Férula by the arm, and led her into the library. "My in-laws were killed in an accident," he told her curtly. "I don't want Clara to find out until after she's given birth. We have to build a wall of censorship around her. No newspapers, no radio, no visitors, nothing. Keep an eye on the servants and make sure no one tells her." But his good intentions were shattered by the strength of Clara's premonitions. That night, she dreamt that her parents were walking through a field of onions and that Nivia had no head, so she knew exactly what had happened without needing to read about it or hear it on the radio. She woke up very agitated and asked Férula to help her dress because she had to go find her mother's head. Férula ran to Esteban and he called Dr. Cuevas, who, even at the risk of harming the twins, gave her a potion for madness that should have put her to sleep for 2 days, but that had not the slightest effect on her. Señor and Señora del Valle had died exactly as Clara dreamed, and exactly as Nivea, jokingly, had frequently announced that they would die. "One of these days we're going to kill ourselves in this damned machine," she would say, pointing at her husband's ancient sunbeam. From his youth, Severo del Valle had had a weakness for modern inventions. The automobile was no exception. In a time when everybody else still traveled by foot, by horse-drawn carriage, or by bicycle, he bought the first car to arrive in the country, which was on display as a curiosity in a downtown shop window. It was a mechanical wonder that moved at the suicidal speed of 15 or even 20 kilometers an hour, to the astonishment of the pedestrians and the curses of those who were splattered with mud or covered with dust as it went by. At first, people fought it as a public hazard. Eminent scientists explained in the newspaper that the human organism was not made to withstand moving about at 20 kilometers an hour, and that the new ingredient called gasoline could catch fire and cause a chain reaction that would consume the entire city. Even the church became involved. Father Restrepo, who had kept a watchful eye on the Del Valle family ever since the disturbing affair with Clara that Holy Thursday during Mass, became the self-proclaimed guardian of morality and railed in his Galician accent against the Amicis Rerum Novarum, the friends of new things such as these satanic machines, which he compared to the chariot of fire in which the prophet Elias disappeared on his way to heaven. But Severo ignored the scandal, and in a short time several other gentlemen followed his example, until the sight of an automobile ceased to be such a novelty. He used it for more than 10 years, refusing to change models when the city swelled with modern cars that were more efficient and safer, for the same reason that his wife refused to get rid of the dray horses until they died peacefully of old age. Inside, the Sunbeam had lace curtains and 2 glass vases, which Nivea kept full of fresh-cut flowers. It was lined with polished wood and Russian leather, and its bronze hardware gleamed like gold. Despite its British origin, it had been baptized with the very Indian name of Covadonga. It was perfect, to tell the truth, except that its brakes never worked very well. Still, Severo was proud of his mechanical abilities. He took the car apart several times, trying to fix it, and then he entrusted it to the big cuckold, an Italian mechanic who was the best in the country. He had acquired his nickname from a tragedy that had cast its shadow over his life. People said that his wife, sick and tired of betraying him without his noticing, abandoned him one stormy night, and before she left him, she took a bunch of ram's horns she had got at the butcher's and tied them to the points of the fence around his garage. The next day, when the Italian arrived at work, he found a knot of children and neighbors making fun of him. That scene, however, in no way undermined his professional reputation, although he too was unable to fix Covadonga's brakes. Severo opted for traveling with a large rock in his car. Whenever he parked on an incline, one passenger would hold his foot on the brake and another would jump out quickly and place the stone in front of the wheels. This system usually worked, but on that fatal Sunday, appointed by destiny to be their last, it did not. The Del Valles motored out into the suburbs as they always did on a clear day. Suddenly, the brakes gave out completely, and before Nivea could jump out with the rock or Severo could alter its course, the car took off downhill. Severo tried to swerve, and then he tried to stop, but the devil had taken charge of the machine, which flew out of control and smashed into a cart loaded with construction iron. One of the plates came through the windshield and decapitated Nivea. It was a clean cut. Her head shot out of the car and, despite a search by the police, the forest rangers, and a swarm of neighbors who searched for it with bloodhounds, after 2 days they had failed to find any trace of it. By the third day, the bodies had begun to stink, and they had to be buried incomplete in a magnificent funeral that was attended by the whole Del Valle tribe and an incredible number of friends and acquaintances, not to mention the delegations of women who went to pay their last respects to the remains of Nivea, who was considered the first feminist in the country. Her enemies said of her that if she had lost her head during her lifetime, there was no reason why she should find it in death. Clara, locked in her house, surrounded by the servants who took care of her, with Férula as her guard, and drugged by Dr. Cuevas, did not attend. Out of consideration for everyone who had tried to spare her this additional suffering, she said nothing that would indicate she knew about the hair-raising affair of the lost head. But once the funeral was over, and life appeared to return to normal again, Clara convinced Férula to go with her to look for it, and there was no use in her sister-in-law's giving her more pills and potions because she was firm in her determination. Defeated, Férula understood that it was no longer possible to say that the image of the lost head was a bad dream, and that it would be best if she helped Clara with her plans before her anxiety completely unhinged her. They waited for Esteban Trueba to leave the house. Férula helped her dress and called for a hired carriage. Clara's instructions to the driver were rather imprecise. "Go straight. I'll tell you the route," she said, guided by her instincts for seeing what was invisible. They left the city and came into the open country where the houses were far apart and the hills and gentle valleys began. At Clara's command, they turned onto a service road and continued among birches and onion fields until she ordered the driver to pull up along a clump of underbrush. "It's here," she said. "But that's impossible. We're too much far from where the accident occurred," said Férula. "It's here," Clara insisted, getting out of the car with difficulty, holding up her enormous belly. She was followed by her sister-in-law, who was muttering prayers, and by the driver, who did not have the foggiest idea of the purpose of their trip. She tried to make her way through the brush, but the twins made it impossible. "Do me a favor, señor," she said to the driver. "Step through here and hand me that woman's head you'll see lying on the ground." He inched his way beneath the thorny brush until he came upon Nivea's head, which looked like a lonely melon. He picked it up by the hair and took it with him, crawling on all fours. While the man leaned against a tree and vomited, Férula and Clara cleaned the dirt and pebbles that had got into Nivea's ears, nose, and mouth, and arranged her hair, which had become rather unkempt. But they were unable to close her eyes. They wrapped the head in a shawl and returned to the car. "Hurry, señor," Clara told the driver. "I think I'm giving birth." They arrived at the house just in time to get the mother into bed. Férula fluttered about with all the necessary preparations while a servant went to fetch Dr. Cuevas and the midwife. With the bouncing of the car, the emotions of the past few days, and the doctor's potions, Clara had acquired a skill at giving birth that she did not have the first time around. She clenched her teeth, grabbed onto the mizen and the foremast of the sailboat, and gave herself fully to the task of bringing forth onto the calm blue silken sea the twins, Jaime and Nicolás, who came sailing out under the gaze of their grandmother, staring open-eyed at them from the bureau. Férula grabbed each of them by the lock of wet hair at their napes and helped to pull them out with the experience she had acquired watching the birth of colts and calves at Tres Marias. Before the doctor and midwife could arrive, she hid Nivea's head beneath the bed to avoid having to invent awkward explanations. When they finally arrived, there was precious little for them to do because their mother was resting comfortably and the babies, as tiny as 7-month-olds, but with all their parts and in good condition, were sleeping in the arms of their debilitated aunt. Nivea's head became a problem because there was no place to put it where it would not be seen. Finally, Férula wrapped it in a cloth and placed it in a leather hat box. They discussed the possibility of giving it a proper burial, but it would have required interminable paperwork to have the tomb unsealed in order to include the missing part. Besides, there would have been an uproar if word had got out about how Clara had found the head where the bloodhounds had failed. Esteban Trueba, ever fearful of public ridicule, opted for a solution that would not provide material for malicious tongues, because he knew that his wife's strange behavior was the target of local gossips. It had gone beyond Clara's skill at moving objects without touching them and at predicting the impossible. Someone had uncovered the story of Clara's childhood muteness and the curse of Father Restrepo, that saintly man who the church was hoping would become the first in the country to obtain beatitude. The 2 years in Tres Marias had helped to quell the rumors, and people had begun to forget. But Trueba knew that it would take a mere trifle, such as the affair of his mother-in-law's head, for the whispers to start up again. For this reason, and not out of neglect, as was later said, the hat box was stowed away in the basement, where it awaited a more propitious moment to be given a Christian burial. Clara recovered quickly from the double birth. She entrusted the care of the children to her sister-in-law and to Nana, who came to work in the Trueba household after the death of her employers, to continue working for the same blood, as she put it. She had been born to cradle other people's children, wear their hand-me-down clothing, eat their leftovers, live on borrowed happiness and grief, grow old beneath other people's roofs, die one day in her miserable little room in the far courtyard in a bed that did not belong to her, and be buried in a common grave in the public cemetery. She was nearly 70, but her zeal was unbending. She was still tireless in her comings and goings, untouched by time, still able to dress up as a ghost and jump on Clara in the nooks and crannies of the house whenever she had another of her spells of muteness, still strong enough to fight with the twins, and soft-hearted enough to spoil Blanca, just as she had spoiled her mother and grandmother before her. She had acquired the habit of constantly mumbling prayers under her breath, because when she realized that no one in the house believed in God, she took it upon herself to pray for all the living members of the family, as well as, of course, for the dead, for whom her devotions were simply an extension of the service she had rendered while they were alive. In her old age, she forgot whom she was praying for, but she kept up the habit, convinced that it would be of use to someone. Her piety was the only thing she shared with Férula. In everything else, they were rivals. One Friday afternoon, three translucent ladies knocked at the door to the big house on the corner. They had eyes like sea mist, covered their heads with old-fashioned flower hats, and were bathed in a strong scent of wild violets, which infiltrated all the rooms and left the house smelling of flowers for days after their visit. They were the three Mora sisters. Clara was in the garden and appeared to have been waiting for them all afternoon. She greeted them with a baby at each breast, and Blanca playing at her feet. They looked at each other, recognized each other, smiled at each other. It was the beginning of a passionate spiritual relationship that was to last the remainder of their lives, and, if their predictions have come true, must still be flourishing in the hereafter. The three Mora sisters were students of spiritualism and supernatural phenomena, thanks to a photograph that showed the three of them around a table with a misty, winged ectoplasm flying overhead, which some unbelievers attributed to a stain from the developer, and others to a simple photographic trick. They were the only people who possessed irrefutable proof that souls can take on physical form. Via mysterious connections available only to initiates, they learned of Clara's existence, established telepathic contact with her, and immediately realized they were astral sisters. By way of a series of discreet inquiries, they managed to obtain her earthly address and arrived at her door with decks of cards impregnated with beneficent liquids, several sets of geometrical figures, and mysterious tools of their own invention for unmasking fate parapsychologists and a tray of ordinary pastries as a gift for Clara. They became intimate friends, and from that day on they met every Friday to summon spirits and exchange recipes and premonitions. They discovered a way to transmit mental energy from the big house on the corner to the other extreme of the city, where the Moras lived in an old mill they had converted into their singular abode, and also in the opposite direction, which enabled them to give each other moral support in difficult moments of their daily lives. The Moras knew many people, almost all of them interested in such matters, who gradually began to attend the Friday meetings, to which they brought their knowledge and their magnetic fluids. Esteban Trueba would see them crossing through his house, and insisted on these few conditions: that they respect his library, that they not use the children for psychic experiments, and that they be discreet, because he did not want any public scandal. Férula disapproved of these activities of Clara's. To her, they seemed at odds with religion and good manners. She observed their sessions from a prudent distance, without participating, but watching from the corner of her eye while she crocheted, ever ready to intervene in case Clara went too far in one of her trances. She had noticed that her sister-in-law was always exhausted at the end of the sessions where she served as medium, and she would begin to speak in pagan tongues, and in a voice that was not her own. Nana also kept her eye out, on the pretext of serving little cups of coffee, startling the spirits with her starched petticoats and the click of her whispered prayers and loose teeth, not to protect Clara from her own excesses, but rather to make sure no one stole the ashtrays. In vain, Clara explained to her that her guests were not interested in ashtrays, primarily because none of them smoked. But Nana had already made up her mind that they were all, with the exception of the three enchanting Mora sisters, a bunch of evangelical scoundrels. Nana and Férula despised each other. They squabbled over the children's affection and fought for the right to care for Clara in her rantings and ravings. Their silent, continuous war was conducted in the kitchens, the courtyards, the hallways, but never near Clara, because the two of them had agreed to spare her that particular anguish. Férula had come to love Clara with a jealous passion that resembled that of a demanding husband more than it did that of a sister-in-law. With time, she lost her prudence and began to let her adoration show in many ways that did not go unobserved by Esteban. Whenever he returned from the country, Férula would manage to persuade him that Clara was in what she called one of her bad spells, so that he could not sleep in the same bed with her and would enter her room rarely, and then only briefly. She would buttress her argument with recommendations from Dr. Cuevas, which later, when he was asked point blank, turned out to have been made up. She found 1,000 ways to come between the husband and wife, and, if all else failed, she would encourage the children to beg their father to take them on an outing, their mother to read them a book, or both parents to watch over them because they had a fever, or to play with them. "Poor things," she would say. "They need their father and their mother. They spend the whole day with that ignorant old woman who fills their heads with outmoded ideas. She's making them into imbeciles with her superstition. What we should do with Nana is put her away. People say the handmaidens of God have a marvelous asylum for old housekeepers. They treat them like real ladies. They don't have to work. There's good food. That's the most humane thing we could do. Poor Nana. She's all used up." Without being able to pinpoint the cause, Esteban began to feel uncomfortable in his own house. His wife had grown increasingly remote, strange, and inaccessible. There was no way for him to reach her, not even with presents. His timid show of affection did not work, nor did the unbridled passion that always overcame him in her presence. In all that time, his love for her had grown to the point where it had become an obsession. He wanted Clara to think of nothing but him, and he could not bear for her to have a life outside that did not include him. He wanted her to tell him everything and to own nothing he had not given her with his own two hands. He wanted her to be completely dependent. But reality was different. Clara seemed to be flying in an airplane, like her uncle Marcos, unmoored from land, seeking God through Tibetan sciences, consulting spirits with a three-legged table that gave little jolts, two for yes, three for no, deciphering messages from other worlds that could even give her the forecast for rain. Once they announced that there was a hidden treasure beneath the chimney, first she had the wall knocked down, and then, when it was not found, the staircase and half of the main sitting room. Still nothing. Finally, it turned out that the spirit, confused by the architectural alterations she had made to the house, was unable to detect that the hiding place of the gold doubloons was not in the Trueba mansion, but across the street at the house of the Ugartes, who refused to demolish their dining room because they did not believe the story about the Spanish ghost. Clara was incapable of braiding Blanca's hair for school, a task she entrusted to Férula or Nana, but she had a wonderful relationship with her based on the same principles as the relationship she had had with Nivea. They told each other stories, read the magic books from the enchanted trunks, consulted family portraits, told anecdotes about uncles who let fly great amounts of wind, and others, blind, who fell like gargoyles from poplar trees. They went out to look at the cordillera and count the clouds, and spoke in a made-up language with no T's and with R's instead of L's, so that they sounded just like the man in the Chinese laundry. Meanwhile, Jaime and Nicolas were growing up apart from the feminine dyad, adhering to the then common belief that we have to become men. The twins grew strong and cruel in the games typical of their age. They chased lizards to slice off their tails, mice to make them run races, and butterflies to wipe the powder from their wings. Then, when they were older, they punched and kicked each other on instructions from that Chinese laundryman who was ahead of his time and had been the first to introduce the country to the millennial practice of the martial arts. But no one had paid any attention when he demonstrated how he could split bricks in two with his hand and had tried to open his own academy. So he had ended up washing other people's clothes. Years later, the twins put the finishing touches on their manhood by escaping from school and diving into the empty lot behind the garbage dump, where they traded some of their mother's silverware for a few minutes of forbidden love with an enormous woman who cradled both of them in breasts like those of a Dutch cow, drowning them in the soft wetness of her armpits, crushing them with her elephantine thighs, and sending them both to heaven with the dark, hot, juicy cavern of her sex. But that was not until much later, and Clara never knew about it, so she could not write it in her notebooks that bore witness to life for me to read one day. I found out from other sources. Clara had no interest in domestic matters. She wandered from one room to the next without ever being the least surprised to find everything in perfect order and sparkling clean. She sat down to eat without ever wondering who had cooked the food or where it had come from, just as she was oblivious to the person serving it. She forgot the names of the servants and even of her own children, yet she always managed to be present, like a cheerful, beneficent spirit, at whose slightest footfall clocks began to wind themselves. She dressed in white because she had decided that it was the only color that did not change her aura. In simple dresses that Férula made for her on the sewing machine, and that she preferred to the ruffled sequined gowns her husband bought with the aim of showing her off in the latest fashions. Esteban had bouts of despair because Clara treated him with the same kindness she displayed toward everybody else. She spoke to him in the same cajoling tones she used to address her cats and was incapable of telling whether he was tired, sad, euphoric, or eager to make love. However, from the color of his rays, she knew at a glance whether he was hatching a swindle, and she could diffuse one of his tantrums with a few simple mocking words. It exasperated him that Clara never seemed truly grateful for anything, and never seemed to need anything that he could give her. She was as distracted and as smiling in bed as she was in everything else, relaxed and simple, but absent. He knew that her body was his to engage in all the acrobatics he had learned in the books he kept hidden in a corner of his library. But with Clara, even the most abominable contortions were like the thrashings of a newborn. It was impossible to spice them up with the salt of evil or the pepper of submission. In a rage, Trueba sometimes reverted to his former sins, rolling with some robust peasant woman in the tall rushes of the riverbank, while Clara stayed behind with the children in the city, and he had to tend to the hacienda in the country. But instead of relieving him, these episodes only left a bitter taste in his mouth. They brought no lasting pleasure, particularly since he knew that if he told his wife about them, she would be appalled by his mistreatment of the other women, but not by his infidelity to her. Jealousy, like many other typical human reactions, was simply not part of Clara's vocabulary. He also went to the Red Lantern a few times, but he stopped going because he could not perform anymore with prostitutes, and he had to swallow his humiliation by stammering various excuses. He had drunk too much wine, had eaten too much at lunch, had been walking around with a cold for several days. Nor did he return to Tránsito Soto, because he sensed that she embodied the real danger of addiction. He felt a terrible desire boiling up within him, a fire impossible to quench, a thirst for Clara that would never, even on the longest and most passionate nights, be satisfied. He fell asleep exhausted, his heart on the verge of bursting in his chest, but even in his dreams he was aware that the woman sleeping by his side was not really there. She was in some unknown other dimension where he could never reach her. At times he would lose his patience and furiously shake her awake, shouting the worst accusations he could think of, but then he would end up weeping in her lap and begging her forgiveness for his cruelty. Clara understood, but there was nothing she could do. Esteban Trueba's exaggerated love for her was without a doubt the most powerful emotion of his life, greater by far than his rage and pride. Half a century later, he would still be speaking of it with the same shudder and the same sense of urgency. In his old man's bed, he would continue to call her name until the day he died. Férula's comments increased Esteban's anxiety. Every obstacle his sister placed between himself and Clara drove him out of his mind. He even came to hate his own children for taking all their mother's time. He took Clara on a second honeymoon to the same places where they had spent the first, and on the weekends, escapades to a hotel. But it was all useless. He was convinced that Férula was entirely to blame, that she had planted an evil seed in his wife to prevent her from loving him, and that she was stealing forbidden kisses that properly belonged to him. He would grow livid with anger when he came upon Férula giving Clara her bath. He grabbed the sponge from her hands, thrust her out of the room, and pulled Clara from the tub practically in mid-air. He gave her a good shaking and forbade her to let herself be bathed again, because at her age it was a vice, and he dried her off himself, wrapping her in her robe and leading her to the bed, feeling all the while that he was acting like a fool. If Férula tried to serve his wife a cup of chocolate, he grabbed it from her hands on the pretext that she was always treating her like an invalid. If she kissed her goodnight, he pulled her away with a sweep of his hand, saying that it was not right for them to kiss. If she chose the best portions for her from the serving tray, he rose from the table in a temper. Brother and sister became rivals, each scrutinizing the other with eyes full of hatred, concocting fine-edged arguments to disqualify each other in Clara's eyes, spying on each other, and growing ever more jealous. Esteban stopped going to the country and put Pedro Segundo Garcia in charge of everything, including his imported cows. He stopped going out with his friends, stopped going to the golf course, stopped working, so as to watch his sister day and night and block her path every time she tried to get near Clara. The atmosphere of the house became dense, dark, and unbreathable. Even Nana walked around like someone haunted. The only one who continued completely unaffected was Clara, who in her distraction and innocence had no idea of what was going on. Esteban and Férula's hatred for each other took a long time to explode. It began with a concealed uneasiness and a desire to offend each other in small details, but it grew until it filled the house. That summer, Esteban had to go to Tres Marias because exactly at harvest time, Pedro Segundo Garcia fell off a horse and ended up in the hospital with a cracked skull. As soon as the foreman had recovered, Esteban returned to the city without telling anyone. On the train he felt a terrible foreboding, and an unspoken desire that something dramatic should take place, but he did not know that the drama had already begun when he desired it. He arrived back in the city in the middle of the afternoon, but went directly to his club, where he played a few hands of poker and dined, without successfully quelling his anxiety and impatience. During dinner, there was a slight earthquake. The crystal chandeliers swayed with their usual tinkling, but no one so much as looked up. Everyone continued eating, and the musicians continued playing without missing a single note. But Esteban Trueba jumped up as if it were an omen. He finished his meal in a hurry, then asked for his check and left. Férula, who usually had nerves well under control, had never got used to earthquakes. She had conquered her fear of the ghosts Clara would invoke and the mice in the countryside, but earthquakes shook her to her bones, and long after they had passed, she was still trembling. That night, she had not yet gone to bed, and she came running into Clara's room. Clara had drunk her evening tea and was sleeping peacefully. In search of a little company and warmth, Férula climbed into bed beside her, careful not to wake her up, and whispering silent prayers so that the tremors would not become a full-blown quake. Esteban Trueba found her there. He entered the house as silently as a thief, went up to Clara's room without turning on the lights, and appeared like a tornado before the two sleeping women, who thought he was in Tres Marias. He leaned over his sister with the same rage he would have felt if she were his wife's seducer. He pulled her from the bed, dragged her down the hall, pushed her down the stairs, and thrust her into the library, while Clara shouted from her bedroom doorway, not understanding what was going on. Alone with Férula, Esteban vented all his fury as an unhappy husband, shouting things at her he never should have said, calling her everything from a dyke to a whore, and accusing her of perverting his wife with her spinster caresses and of driving her crazy, distracted, mute, and spiritualist with her arsenal of lesbian arts. He accused her of taking her pleasure with Clara while he was away, and of besmirching the names of the children, the honor of the house, and the memory of their dear departed mother, and told her he was sick and tired of her evil tricks and that he was throwing her out of the house. She should leave immediately, and he never wanted to set eyes on her again. He forbade her to come near his wife and children, and promised that she would never want for money as long as he lived. He would see to it that she had enough to live on decently, as he had once promised her, but that if he ever caught her prowling around his family, he would kill her on the spot, and she should get that through her head. "I swear to you in the name of our mother that I'll kill you. I set my curse on you, Esteban," Férula shouted back. "You will always be alone. Your body and soul will shrivel up and you'll die like a dog." And she left the big house on the corner forever, dressed only in her nightgown, taking nothing with her. The next day, Esteban Trueba went to see Father Antonio and told him what had happened without going into detail. The priest listened passively with a bland expression of one who has heard it all before. "What do you want from me, my son?" he asked when Esteban had finished speaking. "That once a month you make sure my sister receives a certain envelope I'm going to deliver to you. I don't want her to have any financial worries, and I must explain that I'm not doing this out of kindness, but because of a promise." Father Antonio took the first envelope with a sigh and sketched the sign of benediction with his hands. But Esteban had already turned to leave. He gave Clara no explanation of what had come between his sister and himself. He told her he had thrown her out of the house and that he strictly forbade her to mention his sister's name in his presence, suggesting that if she had a shred of decency, she would also refrain from mentioning it behind his back. He had all Férula's clothing and any objects that might serve as reminders of her removed from the house and resolved that as far as he was concerned, his sister was dead. Clara understood there was no point in asking any questions. She went to the sewing room to look for her pendulum. Then she spread a map of the city on the floor and held the pendulum a foot and a half above it, waiting for the oscillations to tell her sister-in-law's address. But after trying all afternoon, she realized that the system would not work unless Ferula had a fixed address. The pendulum having failed, she went out to look for her by carriage, hoping that her instinct would guide her in her search. But that method was also unsuccessful. She consulted her three-legged table, but no spiritual guide showed up to lead her through the city to Ferula. She called her with her mind and consulted her tarot cards, but it was all to no avail. Finally, she decided to resort to more traditional techniques. She began to look for her through friends and by asking the various delivery men who came to the house and might have come across her, but no one had seen a trace of her. Eventually, her investigation led her to Father Antonio's door. "Don't look for her," the priest told her. "She doesn't want to see you." Clara realized that that was why none of her infallible methods of divining had worked. "The Mora sisters were right," she said to herself. "You can't find someone who doesn't want to be found." Esteban Trueba entered a very prosperous period. His business deals seemed to have been touched by a magic wand. He felt pleased with life, and he was rich, just as he had once set out to be. He had acquired the concessions for the other mines, was exporting fruit to foreign countries, had founded a construction firm, and Tres Marias, which had greatly expanded, was now the best hacienda in the area. He had been untouched by the economic crisis that convulsed the rest of the country. In the northern provinces, the collapse of the nitrate fields had left thousands of workers destitute. Hungry tribes of unemployed workers and their families, women, children, and old people, had taken to the roads in search of work and, as they approached the capital, were slowly forming a belt of misery around it. They settled in any way they could, under planks of wood and pieces of cardboard, in the midst of garbage and despair. They wandered the streets begging for a chance to work, but there were no jobs, and slowly but surely, the rugged workers, thin with hunger, shrunken with cold, ragged and desolate, stopped asking for work and asked for alms instead. The city filled with beggars, and then with thieves. Never had there been such terrible frosts as there were that year. There was snow in the capital city, an unaccustomed spectacle that remained on the front page of all the newspapers, touted as a festive decoration, while in the impoverished shanty towns on the city's outskirts, the blue, frozen bodies of small children were discovered every morning. There was not enough charity for so many poor, defenseless people. That was the year of exanthematic typhus. It began like any other calamity that strikes the poor, but quickly took on the characteristics of a divine punishment. It was born in the poorest quarters of the city, because of the harsh winter, the malnutrition, and the dirty water, and it joined forces with the unemployment and spread in every direction. The hospitals could not cope. The sick wandered through the streets with missing eyes, picking the lice from their hair and throwing them at the healthy. The plague spread to every house, infecting schools and factories so that no one felt secure. Everyone lived in fear, inspecting themselves for the first signs of the dread disease. Those who caught it began to shake with an icy cold that lodged in their bones and gradually fell prey to a deep lethargy. They were left gazing like madmen to be eaten alive by their own fever, filling with sores, shitting blood, hallucinating scenes of fire and drowning, falling to the ground with bones like wool, legs like rags, and the taste of bile in their mouths. Their bodies became raw meat, with a red pustule next to a blue one, next to a yellow one, next to a black one, as they vomited up their own intestines and cried out to God for mercy, begging him to let them die for they could not go on. Their heads were bursting, and their souls escaping in a blur of shit and fear. Esteban proposed to take his whole family to the countryside to protect them from the infection. But Clara would not hear of it. She was busy tending to the poor in a task that had neither beginning nor end. She left the house early in the morning and at times returned close to midnight.